Today we find ourselves between the second and third Sundays of the fast, so we should speak about what takes place on the third Sunday. On that day, the Church brings forth the precious cross for the faithful to venerate and to receive strength, so that they may complete the remainder of the season known as Great Lent. For the third Sunday of the fast comes at about the midpoint of the whole season. If we look back to where we began and then ahead to where we are going, we find ourselves roughly halfway through. Therefore, the Church brings out the precious cross without the crucified Christ upon it, so that we may venerate it and draw strength from it. As I said, this is so that we may complete the remainder of the season. That is why it is called the Sunday of the Veneration of the Cross. I do not know whether you have ever reflected on this, but in the Church the cross is presented almost as a person. Many times we ask for its intercessions, that is, we seek its power, just as we appeal to our most holy Theotokos and to the saints. So we also appeal to the precious cross as though it were a person. This, then, is how an Orthodox Christian should regard this precious wood. Of course, to many people it means nothing, but to those who truly believe, it is a mighty weapon. Satan knows very well exactly what the precious cross is. He knows very well what it is. We, on the other hand, go so far as to blaspheme the cross, and that is no small thing. Many people blaspheme the cross, mind you. Many others make the sign of the cross. They do not blaspheme it. They seal themselves with it. But there is no full understanding of the power of the precious and life-giving cross. That is why you see Christians failing to seal themselves properly with the precious cross. They make some ridiculous gesture in front of themselves, merely stirring the air a little. I once said that they make something like a hen scratching the ground. Just as hens scratch about, so they stir their hands around and make some shape in front of themselves. What that is, I do not know. In any case, it is not the cross. So I take this opportunity to urge those of you who are watching and listening to me now, as well as those who will hear me through this recording, to pay attention to this. Nobody is forcing us. It's for our own good. If I want to believe in the crucified one, if I make the sign of the cross, and if I believe that the cross has power and helps me in my life, then I must learn to make the sign of the cross correctly. I should bring three fingers together, fold the other two down, and first touch my forehead. Then my hand should come down to my abdomen, then to the right, and then to the left. All this waving about in different directions, all these empty gestures and the like are ridiculous. They are blasphemous. The three hypostatic God once became man. This is what your hand signifies when you hold it this way. The three hypostatic God once became man, God and man. The two fingers we fold down here signify the human and divine natures of Jesus. God is without beginning. That is why the sign begins at the head, which represents what is without beginning. It is round, without corners, with no beginning and no end, the beginningless God. It signifies that he became man in the womb of the most holy Theotokos. Then what did he do? He ascended. And what is going to happen again? Once more, he is the one who is coming. He will come again to judge the living and the dead. That is what the whole thing means. So the person who doesn't cross himself properly isn't really making three crosses at all. Let him make one sign of the cross, but let it be a proper one. He should touch his hand to his forehead, then bring it down to his abdomen, and then to each shoulder. He should not merely touch his waistcoat or the buttons of his jacket. That is not the cross. It is a blasphemy against the cross. That is what I want to say. If you wish, sit one day opposite the iconostasis and watch people as they enter the church. If 1,000 people come in, you will see perhaps one or two make the sign of the cross properly. The others make empty gestures, striking and beating the air, and when a seal has not been firmly impressed, the document is not accepted. The seal must be clearly impressed. Therefore, you must seal yourself properly with the cross of the crucified Christ so that Satan cannot lay a hand on you. Yet people do not do this, priests do not do it, bishops do not do it, and even people who have been religious for many years do not do it. This is a fundamental matter, and we must learn it from childhood, because it becomes a habit. If you believe that this has some value, then hold on to it. I am not speaking here about the doctrinal teaching concerning the cross, how far back its history reaches, and so forth. Some call it an instrument of death and say that it killed Christ, but it was not the cross that crucified Christ. It was the Jews who crucified Christ, and now they seek to put the instrument on trial and acquit the murderer. That is what people do. Is the gun to blame? Do we put the gun in prison or the person who pulled it? Sadly, that is how it is. In any case, let us look at some remarkable words in the Gospel. They are taken from Mark chapter 8, verse 34 and on. It says, "And he called the crowd to himself, along with his disciples, and said to them, Whoever wants to follow after me, whoever wishes to follow after me, he says, let him deny himself, take up his cross, and follow me." Christ had not yet been crucified, so what cross was he speaking about? What do we learn from this here? He speaks of the cross before the cross. Whoever wishes, he says, will come after me, but he will not come empty-handed. He will take up his own cross, not my cross. He will take up his own cross and follow me. Two things follow from this. First, Christ does not compel anyone. Whoever wishes, if you believe that my teaching is true, if you see that what I say is beneficial, if what you hear is something you need, and if you are willing, then come. Everything may be good, yet you may be unwilling for a time, or even unwilling to the very end. That is your own affair. But if you do choose to come and say, I will go with you, then take care. You will not go ahead of me, nor will you stand beside me. You will come behind me, and at the same time you will carry your cross. It is unthinkable for a Christian to bear the honored name of Christ without also bearing a cross. The cross is not merely the sign we make. It is not simply the wood, the shape, or the cross we hang around our necks, while many times, even with the cross around our necks, we remain in sin. That's not what it is. To crucify means to put to death. To crucify means to mortify. Put yourself to death. When Christ says, take up your cross, you must take up your cross and crucify yourself. You must crucify your passions so that they are put to death. You must crucify your own will so that your will is not done, but mine. For when he says, follow me, I will go before you and you will come behind me. We Christians today are meant to have Christ as our guide and follow in his footsteps. Yet today it is we who lead Christ instead of allowing him to lead us. Where does this lead us? We insist on doing our own will and following our own path, yet Christ compels no one. Know this well, he says. If you wish, come. If you do not, then live as you please. And if you can preserve your life and never die, then good for you. Go your way gladly. So let us not grumble against Christ. That is your choice. But I had seriously considered this. You will depart from this world, and then you will realize that you should have followed me on the path for which I came to this earth. Just as I crucified my own will, even though my flesh did not desire the cross. The flesh does not want a cross, it suffers and is crushed. Thank you. Father, let this cup pass from me. Yet again, not my will, but yours be done. You were unwilling to accept my will, though it was for your own good. I crucified my own will and said, let the will of the Father be done. And the Father's will was that I should be crucified, and so I was crucified. Therefore, if you wish to come near me, you too must crucify your own will. You must crucify your own cleverness and your own knowledge. Sadly, this is lacking in most Christians. They do their own will, follow the ways of the world, and obey the desires of their flesh. They throw themselves into the sciences. They do this, they do that, they do the other thing. The one thing they don't do is Christ. And again, in our own life, when it comes to the cooking pot, when it comes to the flesh, when it comes to the bed, when it comes to our own advantage, we do our own thing. Let Christ say what he will. Let the gospel cry out. Let the preachers shout. We still do our own thing. And the satanic part of it is that we even try to claim that the gospel supports these things. Do you understand? We seek to justify our passions by using the gospel itself. That is the saddest thing of all. Now someone may ask, why does he tell me to go behind him, as I said earlier, rather than ahead of him? What can you possibly offer by going ahead of Christ? Do you have some advice to give him? Can you show him a road he does not know? You need him. He does not need you. And what would you do beside him? Walk as equals and discuss things together. This is my opinion. This is what I imagine. Lord, what do you say? Who are you to speak this way? Has Christ made some mistake in his teaching? Is the teaching of Christ open to debate? Can the all-embracing wisdom of Christ be called into question? After all, from the moment a person is baptized, spits upon Satan, renounces him, and unites himself to Christ, he is in a state of war. And when you go to war, do you go out in front, or do you make sure to remain behind, taking cover behind the rocks and behind the others? How then? Can you rush to the front when you think you know everything, refuse to listen to anyone, and insist on doing things your own way? The first shot Satan fires will take off your head, precisely because you are following your own will. It is for our good to have Christ before us. It is for my good to take shelter behind someone. Once a Turk was pursuing a Greek Orthodox Christian who ran into a church. He did not have time to enter the sanctuary. He did not have time. There was a large icon of the Most Holy Theotokos on a stand, so he went and hid behind it. Of course, his whole body was still visible. He was hidden from the waist up, though even his head could still be seen a little. The rest of him remained visible. The Turk took aim and calculated where the man's head was. His head was directly behind the head of the Most Holy Theotokos in the icon. The Turk, acting with utter impiety, drew his pistol and fired at her. And what happened? The bullet turned back, killed the Turk, and the Christian was saved. He had placed the Most Holy Theotokos before him, through her icon. This is the icon known as Dinius. If anyone knows Turkish, Dinius means return, or something like that in their language. It is the icon of Dinius, which is kept at Zirakori near Chalkida. It remains there to this day in a monastery dedicated to it, and the icon still bears the bullet hole in its head. The Most Holy Theotokos took the bullet, and the Christian was saved. So whom do you put before you, and whom do I put before me? Why do you want to go in front? Was Christ mistaken when he told you, "Walk behind me, come after me, and I will be your guide"? If people today have made shipwreck of their lives, if families have fallen apart, if nations have been brought to ruin, it is because they do not have Christ as their guide. They do not want him in their lives as their guide and captain. They do not seek his counsel or heed his word. Those who acknowledge him at all treat him merely as a servant, while others do not even take his existence into account. Yet Christ says that whoever wishes may come after him. By bringing Christ into his life, a person makes his own path through life easier. I do not know whether you have noticed this when riding a trolley bus or bus. Usually the exit is at the front, and when the bus is crowded, everyone presses around you as you try to reach the front door and get off. How are you going to get through that crowd, especially with a few bags in your hands? Where are you supposed to go? So you ask the man in front of you, "Excuse me, are you getting off?" "Yes." "You're getting off, sir?" And he says, "Yes." "Ah," and just like that, you settle down, you relax. Why? Because now he's the one who will do the pushing. He's the one who will get trampled, and you will slip through right behind him. And this is with a mere human being, and you feel such relief. So with Christ going ahead of you, what will you feel? What will you feel? And yet people don't want Christ as their guide. That is why there are rivers of tears in marriages, rivers of tears in shipwrecks in business, rivers of tears in life, one failure after another. Why? Because no one asks Christ, and people do not want him to go before them. Christ may often choose not to lead us along the road preferred by our pride. He may not take us through life's broad avenues, past all its glittering shop windows. He may lead us along narrow tracks and footpaths, but he will bring us safely through. How many people, when seeking to capture a fortress, have used hidden tracks and guides who knew the paths? and how many undertakings, especially military operations, depend upon precisely this kind of guidance. If a human being can save you and keep you from complete destruction, how much more can Christ do so? A person must not go ahead of Christ or travel without Christ. He must always desire to place Christ before him. Saint Cosmas the Aetolian, during the years when he served as a missionary to the Greek people under Ottoman bondage, offered a short prayer every morning. He would turn toward the east and say, "My Christ, go before us again today." Then he would make the sign of the cross and set out. That was his prayer. Go before us. Take the lead and guide us, showing us where to go and how. A person does not know where to go or how, nor does he know what awaits him around the next corner. If he placed Christ before him, Christ would protect him beforehand. But people seldom place Christ before them, and so he does not intervene to protect them. On a large passenger ship there was a young Christian who always said, "If God wills, we shall arrive." When someone asked the captain, "Captain, when do you expect us to reach port?" he would answer, "On the 29th of the month, at such and such an hour." The young man would immediately add, "If God wills." The captain would say, "Go away with all this talk of God. If God wills, we are here. The engine is running. We have made our arrangements, and that is when we shall arrive." So at one point they arrived in New York, and they were supposed to leave the next day. The captain said the same thing again, and this boy, who was just about the youngest one on board, spoke up. The captain said, "We leave tomorrow at noon, if God wills," says the boy. So the captain turns around, glares at him, and he says to him, "Captain, if God wills..." I don't know. Did he curse at him? I don't know what happened. In any case, the boy walked away and went on further. And he said, "We'll reach the port at such and such a time," and so on. Because someone was asking so he could write it down. So he could write it down. He wanted to write home, I suppose, to say that he would be there at that time, so they could arrange a phone call. Something like that. The upshot is that the young man, when he left there and went on a bit further, fell down one of those vertical ladders. He went down the ship's ladder, one or two decks down. Goodness knows how far he fell, and he broke both his legs clean through. He hit so hard that they couldn't even move him an inch, and the result was that the others started laughing. "This gentleman who leaves everything up to God, why didn't God protect him now, when he's gone and broken his legs down there? And he would have to stay behind. They had to take him off the ship and leave him in a hospital in America." And sure enough, the ship departed the next day. Meanwhile, he wrote home, "I have fallen ill and will not be sailing. I have remained in New York. In a few days I shall write and tell you how my illness is progressing, though I believe I shall recover very quickly. Do not worry." After the ship departed, it caught fire at sea the following evening and burned with everyone aboard. The newspapers reported it, and the international news agencies sent word. His family learned of it. They heard the news at home, and there was weeping, lamentation, memorial services, and all the rest. 6 or 7 days later, they received his letter and discovered that their young man was still there in New York. Of course, if they had received the letter before the ship caught fire, they would have said, "Oh dear, the poor child, this has happened to him, and that as well." But now the ship had caught fire and burned. The others were gone while their child was alive. Glory to God. Now he glorifies God because God went before him, broke both his legs, and kept him there. Secondly, human wisdom cannot imagine the ways Christ can arrange events to save a person, help him, and preserve him from disaster. And a person must have absolute faith in God. Unfortunately, we do not have this awareness. Something like this happened to me, showing how God acts without our knowing it. It is enough, however, to say to him, "My God, you know, you arrange everything." In fact, I was speaking somewhere just the other day, and they challenged me, and I said it. Besides the other 6 illnesses I have, I had suffered from a hernia for 22 years. You know, hernias are the lot of public speakers because of the strain involved in speaking. 99% of speakers have a hernia. In any case, I suffered for 22 years. Lately, however, I could no longer endure it, and I had to undergo surgery. So I made my preparations and went to my surgeon. He examined me, and we arranged for me to go in on Monday. I saw him on Wednesday, and the operation was scheduled for Monday. Everything had been arranged on Thursday. While speaking with a monk, I told him that I would not be coming to give the talk the following Thursday. You should know that I will not be there. I will send someone else in my place, but do not tell the people. Why? He asked. I explained what was happening. What are you saying? He replied. I had the same thing. Do not have the operation. I cannot endure it any longer, I told him. I have suffered for 22 years. I would curl up in pain at the lectern, though the people did not know what was wrong with me. Go to St. Artemios, he told me. Ask for his intercessions. Look at me now, walking along the road, carrying bags full of books. St. Artemios healed me. I took that to heart, my nose, my spiritual intellect was opened, and I resolved to do it. I will go, I told him. So I got up and went to St. Artemios. I had been preaching at St. Artemios for 6 or 7 years, so I went there in a way, as one of the household. I laid my case out before him. This and this is what's happening to me, and you know it. You yourself suffered, and our Lord gave you a special grace for the reproductive organs, for the bowels, and so on. If you wish, since I am an old acquaintance of yours here, let us avoid this operation. Let me not go and have them cut me open, leaving me confined for 15 days without even knowing whether I will recover. Some people have undergone 3, 4, 5, or 6 operations for a hernia, only for the hernia to return. Do whatever you think best. I'll take a little oil and anoint myself with it. You arrange how it turns out. The saint, it seems, took that seriously, and the Lord, it seems, signed off on it. Go ahead, give that fool over there what he wants. Let him get well, or whatever it was he said to him. I took the oil, and the saint healed me. But I did not know that I had been healed. I continued to feel pain, although the saint had healed me. Several days had to pass before it became evident that I was well. I had to remove the support and let it stop holding the abdominal wall in place. Only then could I know whether anything had truly happened. But I had an appointment to go in on Monday. On Sunday afternoon, however, my wife fell and broke her leg. It is for a person's own good to accept Jesus Christ, who asks us to take him as our guide. Christ himself has traveled the road that a person must follow to return to paradise. He has gone there and come back, and he knows the way, which is easier to set out and try to find your way somewhere on your own, or to have a guide who knows the road, and yet man does not want Christ. Of course, as I said, the road is narrow. It is not the broad road, the way people would like it to be. Not the way people want it, that is, the road is narrow. And afflicted is the way that leads to life. It is winding. When Scripture says afflicted or hard-pressed, it doesn't mean dressed in black and going about in mourning. It means the road twists and turns. And if a road has bends in it, how does someone driving a car travel on it? Tell me, always carefully. They always take care to drive sensibly. A careful driver follows the rules of the road so that, if the other driver does the same, they will not collide. He always drives defensively. At every bend, he expects someone to appear, even when no one is there, so that he may remain safe. But if he takes the attitude that the road belongs to him, then at the first or second bend he'll crash, he'll be killed. That's what the Christian road is like. The Christian road is narrow and full of affliction, the straight and narrow way, and it twists and winds. You don't know what tomorrow will bring. You do not know what may happen to you in a few minutes. You may make appointments and plans, but do not be so sure. Say before everything else, God first. What does God first mean? It means God goes before us. That is what God first means, God goes before us. Think for a moment about some of the little turns of phrase we use, the ones that bring God into it. We say, we'll go tomorrow, of course, God willing and weather permitting. Do you hear that? In other words, God may want it, But if the weather doesn't want it, God willing, yes, but also weather permitting. God may want it yet. If God wills something, is there any possibility that the weather gets to direct God? We are treating God as if he counted for nothing. Without realizing it, we blaspheme God in our ignorance. This is so serious that James, in the mere 4 or 5 chapters he wrote, considered it necessary to address it. Are you not ashamed, he says, to sit there calculating that you will go to such and such a country, as so many people say? I'm off to Germany. I'll make money. I'll come back here and build. I'll add another floor on top here. I'll sell you the air rights above it. I'll put up a place, and so on and so forth. And he only manages to get as far as Domokos, and he's killed. Or he goes to Germany, and on his way back everything is stolen from him in Italy. So he returns penniless. He does not say, God willing, with God's help, I intend to go there, and I ask him to permit this journey if it is for my good. May he allow this business venture, but if it is not for my good, may he place obstacles in my way. This then is what James says. Are you not ashamed to speak as you do? Instead of saying, if God wills God first? For God always desires what is good for us, both in this temporal life and in eternity. And he has the power to arrange matters so that this temporal life is bearable for a person, while also securing eternal life for him. Yet you see businesses shipwrecked, homes shipwrecked, and people shipwrecked, because they do not have Christ at the helm. And whoever does not have Christ at the helm has the devil at the helm. Someone is inevitably at the helm, because egotism is Luciferian. I know, I said it, I asked about it, I did it, I made it. Very well then, put God first, and follow behind him. That is why he says, if anyone desires to come after me, not even beside me. Many people think they can offer their opinion on how things ought to be. Whether it should rain today or not, whether the wind should blow or not, whether there should be a downpour or not, whatever the weather should do. People have opinions with which they would advise God himself. Read the Wisdom of Solomon and see what it says there about the wisdom of God. Who is there that can advise God? Who can voice the opinion that this was not done properly, or that it should have been done this way rather than another? We all draw wisdom from him. If he does not grant wisdom, everything is in vain. There is nothing. Can wisdom be borrowed? Where do you expect to find wisdom from a firefly? What is man? Man may possess some knowledge, yet entertain many thoughts and reach groundless conclusions. So this is not a matter for debate, as we so often hear people say, I think that if... Who are you to think so? I imagine that it will not. Who are you to imagine so? These things are written plainly and laid bare. Do this, and that will be the result. Do that, and this will be the result. It is written clearly. These things are not revised, modified, changed, or altered. They will happen exactly so. Do you know what he says a little further on in one passage? For whoever desires to save his life will lose it. Just try to comprehend that. But whoever loses his life for my sake and the gospel's sake will save it. What human reasoning can grasp this? And yet it is so you cannot say, I will live life my own way, but I will save my soul as well. No, your life here may be a frying pan. Is there any possibility of saving your life? If you indulge yourself in this life, you will lose your soul. He has made it all clear. No one can alter it, no matter how fiercely all the theories of the world protest. Let all the great and powerful cry out, the educated and the uneducated, even the servants of Satan. This cannot be altered. God has spoken, and so it will remain. How is it that, to this day, the enemies of Christ have not taken the gospel into their own hands and made it say whatever they want? Yet it remains here and demands that people put it into practice. You cannot have both. You cannot enjoy both, the works of the flesh, the world, egotism, and Satan, while at the same time saying, I will save my soul as well. Your soul will not be saved. You must lose this life if you wish to save your soul in the life to come. And yet you will not truly lose it, because the Christian lives a life so peaceful, serene, free from anxiety, and blessed that even the angels envy it. Such is the life of the true Christian in contrast to the life of everyone else. Jealousies, murders, envy, sickness, unforeseen accidents amid all this madness, what does not happen? The lives of those who live far from Christ and without Christ are full of torment. Their lives are tormented. People have nightmares. They cannot sleep, apart from those who suffer terrible bodily consequences from various forms of misconduct, from affairs with women or with men, and apart from those wasting away because of drugs or other forms of debauchery. The psychiatric hospitals are full. The whole world has become demonized. People wander the streets talking to themselves. Why? Because they live far from Christ. They do not want Christ. They do not want His gospel. They do not want His church. And they do not want their priests. Yes, their priests, they do not want them. The world is full of people who have lost their minds. Did you read the statistic published in the newspaper the other day? It struck me. So I cut it out and kept it in my diary. Listen, and I will read it to you. You will see what becomes of a person, a family, or a society without Christ as its guide. 120 million mentally ill people in the world, the headline reads. Mental illness has begun to abound in our world, and the number of sufferers has reached 120 million. By the end of the century, it will reach 200 million. These figures were released by the International Labor Organization. This is therefore an official study, and its report stresses that mental disorders are tending to become one of society's gravest problems. According to the report, cases of mental illness are increasing each year at a rate 3% higher than the growth of the world's population. In the United States, approximately 800,000 Americans are residents of various psychiatric institutions. Every year, 5 million Britons turn to their family doctor, that is, a psychiatrist, with symptoms requiring psychiatric care. Of these, 600,000 are referred by their physicians to specialist neurologists and psychiatrists, and 250,000 are admitted to psychiatric hospitals. This is the world today. And why is this? Because people do not have Christ as the guide of their lives, not in their homes, not in the way they govern their bodies, and not in their work. Swallows will go crashing into the wires. Yes, this is what happens to people who are far from Christ and do not want Him, or who think themselves clever about such matters. It is not as they imagine. So if you're willing, put Christ into your life. Christ would have you bear your cross, just as He bore His. Paul expresses it beautifully when he says that Christ did not please Himself. That is, He did not choose what He Himself might have wanted, what would have been comfortable and painless for Him. The reproaches of those who reproached you fell on Me. Sorrows, sufferings, malice, Satan, everything fell upon Him. Yet He bore it all and endured it. For, as you know, all who desire to live godly lives will be persecuted. Resolve to do what is right, and you will meet with hostility. Resolve to live a chaste and moral life, and you will be mocked. If you are moral and honest, your companions will call you a fool and treat you like their beast of burden. That is what society says today. Let a mother resolve to honor the dignity of motherhood and bear as many children as God gives her, and others will jeer and mock her. Oh, so now you are talking to me about that breeding rabbit? Do you have the strength to bear this cross? Resolve to become a Christian, and people will label you accordingly. You will therefore bear your cross. They will mock you, revile you, and crucify you every day. You will hear words that make you say, "It would be better if they crucified me than speak such words to me." Their words will pierce your heart. These are the marks of Christians. It is easy to follow the current and go along with the world so that you meet no resistance, but the current always flows toward the waterfall. It always goes downward. How will you go against the current? The more faithfully you try to walk, the more strongly you will feel the world opposing you, and not only the world outside, but those within your own family. The first to mock you and the first to drive nails into you each day will be your own people. It may be your mother or your father. It may be your brothers and sisters, your husband or your wife. It may even be a clergyman who, through his own carelessness, has become an instrument of Satan. He too drives nails into you. The Christian's struggle is great. That is why he must shelter behind Christ if he wishes to pass through this obscure channel called our temporary life here. This is why Christ says, "Come behind me. Let me put my back before you and protect you. Come behind me." It is to our benefit, I repeat, to bring Christ into our lives. He says this for no other reason. If people knew that Christ plays the part of Simon of Cyrene in their lives, helping them bear their crosses, their lives would be very different. People do not know this, so they bear the burden alone and suffer. Through Peter, he says, "Cast all your care upon him, for he cares for you. I have a burden, I have a temptation, I have a cross. Leave it on Christ." When our Christ as a man was carrying his own cross and fell, according to tradition, 88 times along that road of martyrdom, and in the end he could not carry it all the way up, they forced Simon of Cyrene into service, the son of Rufus, and he took the cross and carried it all the way to the top. God, having become man, had a man to help him, one called Simon of Cyrene. When a man becomes a Christian, whom does he have as his helper? Jesus, the Nazarene, the crucified one. Many people say, "If I did not have Christ, I would have taken my own life many times over." He comforts me. In him I feel understood. You go to prayer and weep. After all that weeping, you would expect to rise from prayer utterly exhausted, yet you rise feeling light, with rest in your soul. What happened? Tell me. By nature, a person who grieves and weeps becomes drained. How then do you grow stronger? This is the mystery. At that moment, Christ takes it upon himself to comfort you and help you with your burden. Often he does not take it away. Sometimes he does, and sometimes he does not. Therefore, a person must learn to ask Christ in this way, "My Christ, I know that you can take away this cross I bear, this affliction. This nail, this thing, whatever it is that is happening at home, at the office, in the neighborhood, at work. But if for a reason that you know you have allowed it to remain, it is like what Daniel said. Do you remember what he said to Nebuchadnezzar? Nebuchadnezzar," he says to him, "we have a God who is able to destroy you and that golden image and all the rest of it, who can turn you to ashes. But even if he does not help us for a reason known to him, and you cast me and those with me into the furnace, we will not worship your image. God is able. But even if for a reason known to him he does not help us, that is not my concern," he tells him. "I'm not going to do that." This is why a person has to learn how to pray. Because we don't really know how to pray. We just fill the air with words about our dear mother, about our dear husband, about our dear wife, about this and that and the other. "Lord, I know that you can help me in this matter. But if you see that it is for my benefit that this temptation, this adversity should remain, then please give strength to my shoulders so that I may bear it. I am not asking you to take it away. Only give me the strength to bear it. Do not let it bend me down. Do not let me fall, deny you, blaspheme, or curse. Help me, grant that I may endure it." And then Christ, who himself received help from a man in the person of Simon of Cyrene while he was present on earth as a man, helps man in return. Yet many times, even though Christ offers to help us in our labor, our worry, our grief, and our difficult situation, we do not entrust our situation to him completely. As though we did not trust him. Yes, but let us also go to a medium and hear what they have to say. Do you understand? Yes, but let us also go to the woman who reads coffee grounds and see what the future holds. Let us go to the card reader too. Yes, yes, how can this be? God stands ready to help every person whose heart is wholly devoted to him. For Scripture says, "The eyes of the Lord range throughout the earth, that he may show himself mighty on behalf of those whose hearts are set on him." He helps those whose heart is wholly devoted to him. That is the heart of the matter. Is our heart wholly devoted to him? Let us cast our care upon him. Take it. I am going to sleep and rest. I am only human, Christ. Take this care and arrange what is to happen in the morning. People have lost their sleep. People have lost their health. People have ended up confined in psychiatric hospitals. Why? because they do not know that Christ stands ready to help them. They have lived far from him. They have made him neither their guide nor their counselor. And even some who say they believe are still like shipwrecked souls. Christian, do you understand what it means to say the Our Father, to acknowledge through it, or rather to confess that you have a Father in heaven, that God is your Father, and yet to live like an orphan? Because you meet many Christians, people have family problems, problems with their children, with their businesses, with their spouse, and so on, and you see them utterly weighed down with worry, and you say, "Come now, my child, aren't you ashamed? You have God as your Father, and this is how you live. Look at you mourning in that sense. Where is your trust?" There was a man who once, so the story goes, was walking along a country road with a sack on his back, when a man came by with a cart, as people used carts in those days, and saw him carrying this heavy load. He asked him, "Where are you going?" The man told him that he was going to the city. "Come," he said, "climb aboard." He felt sorry for the man as he walked along, so the man climbed up. The cart was long, and he climbed aboard with his sack. After quite some time, the driver turned around to see how the man in his cart was doing, and he saw that the man was sitting there but still had the sack on his shoulder. He stopped, it seemed so strange to him. "My good Christian," he said, "I picked you up so that you could rest from carrying that sack, yet even on the cart you still have it on your back." The man replied, "Thank you very much, but do you know what I was thinking?" "What were you thinking?" "Well, you have taken me aboard," he said, "and you are carrying me. You should not have to carry my sack as well." That is how it was, and that is how it still is. Many people climb aboard Christ's chariot, but they bring the sack with them, the sack still on their back, their own opinion that this too had to go the way they thought it should. Never mind what the law said, one thing or another, what the lawyer said, and so on and so forth. All your care, do you know what care is? A drill boring into you, cast it upon him, for he cares for you. He cares, it matters to him. We don't care. "Come and see how I'm suffering," some people say, "so you don't care." But he does care about us. Each person is part of Christ, and Christ takes him into account. We do not take Christ into account, but he takes us into account. Whoever trusts him will find him ready to help and ready to stand beside him. This, then, is precisely why we must put into practice what Christ said. He did not say it out of self-love. A self-centered man wants you to go ahead of him. Ah, he even allows us to express an opinion. But your weak little legs, O man, cannot walk ahead of Christ. You do not know where to go, where to set your foot, or where you will end up. I remember something I once read. A king took his young son, the prince, out for a walk one afternoon. Without realizing it, they wandered far from the city and reached a remote place. Meanwhile, the weather turned bad, thunder began to rumble and crash, and snow began to fall. The king saw that they were in danger of becoming lost. The snowstorm had cut off the way back, so he decided they must walk quickly and reach the village. He said to the young prince, "Listen, come with me as quickly as you can. Soon the snow will trap us, night will fall completely, and the wild beasts, the wolves, will devour us out here tonight." The boy gathered his strength and kept going, but how long could his little legs hold out? He now had to trample down the snow, and walking through it was difficult. While it was still shallow, he managed somehow. "Father, I can't go any further," he says to him. So the king says to him, "Come here," he says, "come along behind me, and step inside my own footprints. Don't step where the snow hasn't been trodden. Stay close to me," he says. And the little one did just that. He kept going. The king went ahead, and with those big feet of his, he pressed the snow down, and it turned firm underfoot. By stepping there, the boy managed to reach the village with him. The snow did not trap them outside, and the wild beasts did not devour them. This is Christ. Walk in the footsteps of Christ, and you will see that you will not grow weary. You will see that you will not be in danger, and that no beast or wild animal will be able to harm or devour you. But who wants to follow the footsteps of Christ? When Christ's footsteps do not lead to nightclubs, to Quintanilla Soniera, to the cafe, to Lealiera, or to the casino, they simply do not go there. You see, Christ's feet do not go to such places, so people do not want his footsteps. They walk according to their own will. They do not want moral discipline. Christ's hands do not perform abortions, and in these days of fasting, Christ's feet do not go to the meat market. So how can I follow Christ when he does not take me where I want to go, where my ego, my flesh, my belly, and my self-interest want to go? This is why we will go to the devil. God is not to blame. We are to blame because we do not follow him. The light came into the world, and man loved darkness. The way came into the world, and man loved the crooked paths and the darkness. Life came into the world, and man preferred death to life. Who is to blame? No one else is. So pay close attention to these words next Sunday. He says, I am not forcing you, my child. But once you say that you will come to me, you must walk behind me. You must take up your cross, the cross of chastity, the cross of self-restraint, the cross of resisting gluttony, the cross of renouncing unlawful gain, the cross of resisting fashion and the ways of the world, and so forth. They will mock you and give you a hard time. Conduct yourself with dignity. Do what is right. Do not let them deceive you into following those paths. Those paths do not lead to life. They lead to perdition. One day you will depart this life, and all you will receive is a grave 6 feet deep, nothing more, and a burial shroud without pockets, so that you can take nothing with you. Then we shall talk about these things.